The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Regular weekly exploration of the world of integrative medicine for cancer. I'm Robin Daly, the founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, which helps people with cancer understand and access integrative medicine. In today's show, I'm looking into an aspect of care that many practitioners are aware of and exploit all the time, and many others consider totally irrelevant. We're going to be looking into the placebo effect, and to do that, I'm going to be speaking to senior Oxford researcher and author, Dr. Jeremy Howick. Jeremy is director of the Oxford University Empathy Programme and has devoted considerable attention to the subject of the placebo effect. Through this, he's developed a great respect for the body's self-healing abilities. I'm speaking to Jeremy in Oxford over Skype. Jeremy, thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk about placebos today, and a placebo is defined as a medicinally inactive substance given as a medicine for its suggestive effect. So it's something that's been known about for hundreds of years, according to the NHS website, the placebo. But now there are many who refer to the placebo effect as anything from outright deception to utterly unimportant, to kind of spurious data. But on the other hand, there's lots of people who'd like to say, well, hang on a minute, if a doctor gives a placebo and the patient recovers and they're really happy about it, didn't they just achieve a great result with no toxicity? So that's quite a big spectrum of opinion. Where do you stand on it?
Well, quite a few things to mention there. So first of all, they say medicinally inactive, which is correct. However, the term inactive is not correct. I mean, they're not inactive. The history of estimating placebo effects dates back to Henry Beecher, published a paper called The Powerful Placebo Effect, where he claimed that 30% of recovery from the things he investigated were due to the placebo effect. He failed to control for natural history. So our bodies are quite powerful at healing themselves. So later on, in 2001, some Danish researchers did an interesting study where they compared the placebo effect with what would happen if they hadn't taken anything at all, and they found much more modest effect sizes. But they were still there for some common ailments, namely pain, most notably pain, as well as nausea, anxiety, depression, and so on. And they did find overall a statistically significant effect of placebos. The way they discuss the results, they say these are, although statistically significant, clinically not relevant, which is debatable.
Right. Okay, so your feeling is that this is something we should be taking an interest in, particularly maybe given some of the more recent research into the sort of body-mind connection.
Well, talking about the placebo research, the surveys around the world show that doctors use them. Of course, depending how you define them, you get different rates, but a large proportion of doctors do use them. They do seem to benefit patients, especially patients suffering from pain. And, you say that without toxicity, there's no kind of medicinal toxicity. However, negative suggestions can produce negative effects. So that's the nocebo effect we might speak about later.
Yeah.
And one of the main objections is that they involve deception. So namely that the doctor has to lie to the patient. That is, recent research has shown that's not true, that you can give what's called an open label placebo, where you give the patient a placebo, you tell them it's a placebo, and it still seems to have an effect.
Mm. Very interesting, eh? Okay, so there's quite a few, a bit of goalpost moving going on during the whole of this debate.
Well, I don't know about that, Rob. By goalpost moving, I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, what do you mean when you say that?
Well, I mean one of the claims, as you were saying, of it being something that was a trick, basically, it was completely changed when somebody actually said, okay, we'll give them openly to people and see what happens. And sure enough, they found this to work.
Yes, they found the research there is not as extensive, so they're doing more of it. There's a trial registered to be conducted in, I think, lower back pain, a bigger one. So there's, but all the research so far points in the same direction, that open label placebos can have effects.
Mm. Okay. Well, just let's talk a bit more about the evidence. I looked at a 2001 systematic review of all the trials on placebos, and they didn't come out much in favour of them. They said they found little evidence in general practice that placebos had powerful clinical effects. So, but that was a while back. There's obviously a lot happened since then. You're obviously presenting a balance of how things stand now. Maybe you could highlight some of the research that's gone on.
Sure. Well, the 2001 systematic review conducted by Robertson and Gooch in Denmark is what I was referring to. They've actually updated that very same review in 2004 and then more recently in 2010 as a Cochrane review. And the 2010 Cochrane review, they, in a way, they confirm their conclusions, but in a way they don't. So their conclusion remains the same, that they claim that placebos don't have powerful effects. However, the more evidence they got, the updated review found a statistically significant benefit of placebos for both objective and subjective outcomes. They claim that these are, statistically, clinically not relevant, that they're modest effects. The same thing, however, applies to the drugs in this area. So, I mean, ibuprofen and NSAIDs don't have a big effect over and above placebo effect. So I've done a systematic review comparing the magnitude of placebo effect, so comparing what happens to someone who takes a placebo to someone who didn't take anything at all, for example, they were on the waiting list, with the magnitude of drug effect, so comparing what happens to someone when they take a drug compared to what happens if they take a placebo. And those two magnitudes are not statistically significantly different. So the drug effect is still bigger than the placebo effect, but the magnitude of the drug effect size is small, and so is the placebo effect compared to what happens, compared to natural history, let's say.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because potentially you're adding two things together there, of course, because when you take a drug, well, the placebo effect is coming into play because you're doing something as opposed to just waiting, and you're having a drug which does hopefully have some effect. So you've got a double whammy in a way.
Yes. Yeah, if you get a treatment, the overall effect can be attributed to three main things. One is the natural history, so what your body does anyway, what's going to happen anyways. Two, the placebo effect, which we can construe as, broadly I construe it to be the effect of any kind of placebo medication, plus the empathic care of the doctor, plus any positive expectations that arise as a result of taking the placebo pill.
Okay. So maybe we can go in a bit now into the mechanism of the placebo effect. Most people have got some sort of idea about it, but maybe you could give us a slightly more precise picture of what the placebo effect is and what we know about how it works.
Yeah, there's been quite a few really interesting studies coming out of California and Italy, and there are numerous mechanisms. For pain, it seems to be the endogenous opioid mechanism. So when you take a placebo, you generate a positive expectation of a good outcome. Mm-hmm. And when you think of a good outcome, that activates the brain's reward mechanism, which leads to the body's producing its own drugs, especially endorphins in the case of reducing pain. So Endorphin, as you know, just means endogenous morphine or morphine that your body makes by itself.
Right.
There's also a conditioning mechanism. So, I mean, many, many bodily processes can be conditioned, including the immune system. So with open-label placebos, they think that conditioning might be the primary mechanism at work, since it could also be expectancy. In spite of the fact that you know you're taking a sugar pill, you might also believe, perhaps rightly, that placebos can help, and so you have a conscious expectancy as well. Mm. And then if we can see the placebo more broadly, so let's say if you take it to be not just the effect of a pill or an injection or a sham surgery or a sham acupuncture, to include the effects of empathic communication, patient-doctor communication, then you can have kind of other mechanisms such as, associated with relaxation and de-stressing.
Right. Well, that's another whole area, isn't it? It's a very interesting one. I want to get into that for sure, because I think that's one of the areas that's the most critical to come out of the whole investigation of placebos. So, clinical trials, they obviously do pay an awful lot of attention to the placebo effect, even though they don't think it's terribly important. But funnily enough, they have to screen it out, really, in order to try and prove that their drug is not just a placebo effect. So maybe you can tell us a bit about how they do that.
So, I mean, they do take it, you said they didn't take it seriously, they do take it very seriously. And yes, I mean, in order for a new drug, for example, to be considered to be effective, they've got to show that it's better than a placebo. And one way to do that is to test it in a placebo-controlled trial. Another way is to test it against some other treatment which itself is believed to be more than a placebo. So in the simple case of a placebo-controlled trial, that's what they do. They kind of create a treatment that looks, tastes, and smells like the test drug, and they randomize, flip a coin, and see who, they don't literally flip a coin, but do something like flipping a coin to see who gets, which patients get the placebo, which patients get the real drug, and then they see what happens, and they hope that the drug outperforms the placebo.
Right, and in order to try and avoid the case of the different interaction between the doctor and patient, the doctors don't know which is which, is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. So you can blind various groups. So typically the patients shouldn't know the difference,
right.
And the doctor shouldn't know the difference, and if you're getting, and also the statisticians shouldn't know the difference. Now, it's one thing to try to make the placebo indistinguishable, it's another thing for it to actually be indistinguishable.
Right.
When people have studied, they ask patients to guess. I mean, if it's truly indistinguishable, I mean, patients shouldn't be able to detect. And in fact, they seem to be able to detect in many of the cases whether they're taking the placebo or the drug, which could be due to side effects. Before they enroll in the trial, they say, well, this drug might make you have a, itchy arm. You're making up an example, an itchy arm, and they get an itchy arm, and they say, well, I must be taking the real drug, not the placebo.
And tell me, do people get side effects from a placebo because they've been suggested?
Well, that's something I'm looking into now, Robin, and I've just done an overview of systematic reviews showing that there are actually substantial dropouts in placebo arms in clinical trials, and the dropouts are attributed to drug adverse events. Now, of course, it couldn't arise due to the medicinal ingredients of the drug they took, because in this case they took the placebo. However, there we face the same problem with natural history. We don't know if their underlying condition, for example, they might have back pain. I mean, the natural history might involve some particularly acute episode, and they might attribute that to the drug falsely. So even there, I don't have any evidence that we control for natural history, but it's suggested that people do. I mean, perhaps due to the informed consent forms they're required to read and understand. They don't always understand them, but when they do, this could lead to what we call nocebo effects, so negative placebo effects. Mm. And there's independent evidence that these kinds of negative suggestions can have negative effects.
Mm. Okay, thank you. Okay, so I want to go on and talk a bit now about this doctor-patient relationship. the clinical style for delivery of findings to patients is developed back in the day. It used to be perfectly all right to just lie outright to somebody who's got terminal cancer and just tell them they'll be fine, kind of in the interest of protecting them from the truth. That's not really considered the right way these days, but it's moved really right the other way in a certain way to a respect for telling it like it is. So the blunt truth is really the thing that's admired now. And it seems like it's a good direction in a way, going from outright lying to telling the truth. But in a way, there's one thing that's been maintained throughout, really, and this is what's called clinical detachment or absence of relationship. And that doesn't seem to change so much at all. How important do you think that empathy is within the doctor-patient relationship, and how does this relate to the placebo effect?
Well, yeah, great question. So first of all, I'm not in a position to make any historical claims about what happened before, whether all patients were lied to. I do know that I've got friends in different countries, and in some countries they do that. It's considered to be the most empathic thing to lie to the person saying you're going to be fine. And here it's certainly not considered to be okay, but I wouldn't myself make any. You may know more about the history of that than I do. But so certainly, I mean, patients want, and in our culture, patients want to be told the truth, which I would too. And they also want to be told the truth in the right way, and they want to have hope without being lied to. And getting that's walking a tightrope. So giving them hope about something, even if it's just kind of the hope for a kind of peaceful end, and at the same time being honest, is not easy. It's you've got to be a great communicator. Susan Block, who in the U.S. was quoted extensively in Atul Gawande's book *Being Mortal*, says it's she has a great quote. Says that it's getting that kind of communication right is as difficult as a complex surgical operation. So that's difficult. It's possible. It's possible with the right training, and some people have it naturally, but it's certainly difficult and not always done well in my experience.
No. To me, the difference between one and the other is that one of them carries with it a kind of certainty of doom, if you like, which is based on some supposed knowledge of the future, which is actually not possible.
Yeah.
And the other says can be real about their own personal experience, or about, what the literature says or whatever, without completely removing somebody's hope, in fact, because actually we don't know what's going to happen in any given circumstance.
No, you know, very few things in medicine life are 100% certain. But we do, people do have good information sometimes about what the prognosis of certain kinds of diseases are. Right. And there's a way to say it in a way that's going to induce nocebo effect, so kind of harm.
Right.
And there's a way to say it in a way which creates hope, and it's not easy, and it should, in our view, be encouraged.
Mm.
And the reason that we're doing research now, we're finding research that I'm doing a review now, where the way healthcare practitioners communicate to patients can have a therapeutic effect.
Right.
So it can reduce pain or it can increase pain. The problem is that this kind of communication it's taught, and in a way it is valued, but it's not valued in the same way that, let's say, a drug is valued, which is unfortunate.
It is unfortunate, yes. That's when I referred back and I said that the researchers didn't think it was very important. I meant they didn't think it was very important in terms of a therapy. Of course, they're interested in the drugs. And you're right. Relatively speaking, it's not really given the kind of importance that maybe it should have.
No, so to me, it's not either or. It's not either drugs or empathy. I mean, in some cases, you may choose one or the other, but it's a matter of both. So you want the best treatments, and drugs aren't the only treatments you have, but I mean, then you want to... you want to communicate it, and it could be different depending on what you have. So, I mean, if I were to make the decision based on evidence that I need surgery of some kind, I personally wouldn't care if the surgeon was empathic. I want them to be a good technician.
Right.
Yes. Good at whatever they're doing. But I mean, but that would be after having made the right decision to me. And coming to that decision might require some good communication. For me, it wouldn't. I'm quite good at searching for the evidence. But whereas for other things, you know, the empathic communication of other people will be much more important. If it's an anxiety-related disorder, then of course just the empathic communication can reduce the anxiety, therefore reduce the symptoms and even sometimes the underlying causes.
Right. Well, that's very interesting because, you know, our healthcare service here is built mainly on acute medicine originally, and I'd say it's really good on acute medicine. And of course, if you've just been scraped off the road, you're unconscious, you don't need much empathy. You need a very quick and technical good response. And I think the NHS is as good as anybody at doing that. It's in the areas where much more care and compassion and, you know, feeling a way forward is required. This is where there's the most complaint about the NHS. So it is this quality of, a clinical detachment versus empathy, if you like, which we're looking at here, which to me, as I think you seem to agree, is incredibly important in the doctor-patient relationship.
So you're making a combination of statements and questions. So when I answer, I don't want to be viewed as kind of confirming all this. So I'm not disagreeing, Rob, but I mean, you're saying things like, you know, it's built on acute care, which is broadly speaking kind of true, and you're saying that, you know, complaints. I don't have access to all the reasons for complaints. I wouldn't want to make a claim myself, which isn't to deny that you can make it if you look at the evidence, but I can only stick to things that I have that I've personally reviewed. So does that make sense?
It does. It completely makes sense.
So what you're saying may well be true. I just don't want to, you know, you kind of, I want to make sure that I'm answering questions that that I feel qualified to answer, which doesn't mean I have sympathy for all those things, but I'd want to look into it before putting my, you know, stamp on those claims, which may well be true, but I just can't know everything.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I can tell you that in a recent survey of NHS patients, over just about a third said there's a major problem with compassion in the NHS. So that's why I'm referring to it in that way. So,
okay, what's the study called?
I don't have it off the top of my head, I'm afraid, but I'll make sure it's put up there with the links.
This is certainly, I'm aware of evidence that, you know, communication reduces medical legal risk, reduces patient complaints, increases patient satisfaction. So, I mean, broadly speaking, you're absolutely correct. I mean, whether or not, you know, where we should point our finger is another matter. I mean, the doctors are often overloaded with too much paperwork, not given enough time and so on. So, you know, the solution is... the solution doesn't involve simply pointing our fingers at, oh, but I'm not, that's not what you're doing, but I mean, it's a complex problem that we are trying to address.
It is indeed, and I'm glad to say that some people have done a lot of work on what the answer could really be. I'm particularly thinking of Dr. Robin Youngson, who's written a book called Time to Care, which is a fantastic mix of good science and real compassion. He's an anesthesiologist himself, and he spent a lifetime looking into the whole question of compassion in healthcare, and he's worked out, well, actually, how do you do it? You know, because as you say, it's not a simple problem, but he actually knows what works and that it can work. So he's looking at it from the inside, if you like, rather than I might be looking from the outside.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm gathering evidence on randomized trials. They randomize some practitioners to get additional empathy training and others not to receive the training, and then they treat patients. We look at patient outcomes, and we're seeing, the results aren't out yet, but we're seeing a mild to moderate effect on patient outcomes, so for anxiety, pain, and depression, of empathy training. And it's about getting this kind of thing valid. So once we have the evidence out there, we can start to do further analyses to see if it's cost effective, etc. Basically, get it recognized as the same as we recognize the value of any treatment, you know, the dose, you know, the health economics, and then begin to encourage it. I mean, you know, most doctors I've talked to would like to take more time and communicate in a way that benefits their patients maximally, but they're being overloaded with too much work. They can't spend more than 10 minutes with each patient. Mm-hmm. They often have difficulty entering the data to the patient record, whatever it's technology. And so we've got to support them as well to do what many of them would like to do. Yeah,
I agree. Okay, so you've already mentioned hope. I want to speak a bit about hope. It seems to me it has a lot to do with the placebo effect. Delivering bad news without any empathy is a lot like being given a death sentence. You know, it's kind of cold and hard, and it may be true, but very lifeless. And we do hear a lot about false hope, particularly in relation to approaches that are other than conventional medicine. They're all claimed as giving patients false hope. So I see hope as one of the basic ingredients of human life, in fact. If you take it away, they quickly lose the will to live. So do you think everyone's entitled to have hope, however difficult their circumstances are?
So again, there's a combination there of statements and questions. So just to make it very clear, I mean, patients want to be told the truth, and they also want to be given hope. And getting that mix correct is not a trivial task. You've got to be a great communicator. I think many doctors are. That kind of communication is often not... We don't support clinicians to be able to do that well in many cases. Don't give them enough time, etc. Now, when you're talking about non-conventional therapies, I mean, I like the word either something's evidence-based or it's not. I mean, I wouldn't want to be... If there's a treatment out there, that whether it's whatever you want to call it, alternative or conventional, where there's no evidence that it works, and or there's evidence that it causes harm, I want to know that. I mean, telling me that, giving me hope at the cost of, you know, lying is different. I mean, so if there's evidence for it, that something works, great. If there's evidence that it's harmful, I want to know. If there's no evidence and there's nothing better, that's maybe what you're talking about. So what patients presumably want is the best possible treatment for what they have.
Right.
And that to know that, you need to look at the evidence. Now, the problem with false hope is what I would consider to be bad is if there was one treatment known based on evidence to be better, and someone was trying to give me hope with a treatment which they don't have any evidence for, but they think for whatever reasons might work, I'd have a big problem with that. However, if there's no treatment known to work, and you know someone wants to try something, and there's anecdotal evidence, you know, but I think that lying to patients to me is a problem.
Hmm. Well, I'd agree with that, and
there's different levels. I mean, some things are evidence-based, some things are not, and sometimes we don't have evidence for anything,
right.
And people are willing to try anything. And oftentimes, the people they're trying to make money off of these different things, and they're playing with people's false hopes. So it's a tricky issue. It's the way I think about it. I try to stick to the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, evidence is a sliding scale. As you know, it tends to get portrayed as black and white. You've got evidence, haven't got evidence. But actually, it's a scale, isn't it, with more evidence or less evidence, or better evidence or not quite so solid evidence. And I think, this is, in general, the circumstances being talked about are the second circumstance you described, which is the one where there's nothing on offer. And somebody comes along with something which has got maybe some evidence, but it's certainly not the best, is that offering someone false hope? That's the question, I suppose. Not the lying one, which is obviously false.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that it's hard to talk about these things outside of, if you have a concrete example, it would be easier. So I think that the one area where we might be able to kind of find some common ground, Robin, is some people often, there's evidence, we would do surveys, people, especially those with cancer, look for kind of alternative cures of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem comes in when they mention this to their doctors, their conventional doctors, and the conventional doctors laugh at them or whatever. So whatever your belief about the alternative cures, it's important to engage in a dialogue about it. And the way that I've taught some medical students here is I say, well, if they ask you about it, I mean, you've got to be open-minded enough to listen, whether or not you agree with it or not. and then look up the evidence. If there's evidence that it's if there's positive evidence that it's harmful, then you have to convey that to the patient. If there's no evidence that it's harmful, and there's some evidence that it's helpful, you might want to recommend it. So acupuncture for back pain, there's quite strong evidence that it's quite helpful. And if there's no evidence that it's harmful and no evidence that it's helpful, well, provided that they can afford it and you're telling them that it's uncertain, then there's no reason why you shouldn't convey that in a way that encourages them to be hopeful. But making a blanket statement about, anything goes as long as it encourages hope, I mean, that's not something that I would endorse.
No, well, I would agree, and wouldn't endorse that nothing goes if I haven't heard of it before.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot that we don't know. Mm. There's a lot that we don't know, and it's important that we, my mother passed away from metastatic cancer, and I mean, she tried everything from, the one trying to lose weight, she lost weight, sort of gained weight, I mean, she had metastatic breast cancer, aggressive metastatic breast cancer, and the prognosis was bad, and she had hope, she tried everything. I mean, the people encouraging her to do those things, they weren't being, to give her hope, but I mean, in a way, it's also frustrating. And I think someone having an honest conversation at the beginning, the prognosis is bad, let's move into palliative care, in her case, would have been perhaps more helpful, although wisdom in hindsight is always 20/20. So it's a very tricky issue. And I think I would stick to the evidence and focus on the ways of communicating this evidence in a way that encourages hope and so on. Mm. But I think, so at a general level, I think you're right, that in my experience, again, caring for my mother, I mean, the doctors did not communicate the realities of the circumstance, did not communicate the realities of the harms of the chemotherapy, and they did not, they were not willing to engage in conversations about other things in a way that was helpful. So that's all true. We can say all that without moving into any kind of controversial areas to me. Does that make sense?
It does. Can I ask you one question about your mother's situation? Did you feel that she was encouraged to do or that she chose to do, which would say to do with dietary or whatever it was, something that was outside of conventional medicine, did any of that cause her to suffer or in some way was it a detriment to her in any way?
It's hard to say definitively, so I'm just giving, I can't read anybody's mind. I mean, I was just there to try my best to support her, whatever she was choosing, and to try to provide her with the best evidence, and again, doing my best to present it in a way, if it was uncertain, say, well, hey, it's not quite certain, but why not give it a try? Mm-hmm. That was my approach. Wisdom in hindsight is always 20/20, but I mean, the prognosis of people with metastatic breast cancer in their lungs, bones, liver, and brain is bad. I mean, there are many cases of, dramatic recovery of the kind you're talking about there. So I think that, in the sense that she tried it and it didn't work, she might have started to feel that, she's not trying hard enough or, why doesn't it work? I mean, a sense of frustration might have come in, whereas at some point, I mean, the writing was on the wall, and no one was stepping up to make that clear until it became eminently clear to her. Mm. So, I don't think it caused harm because of the best of intentions. However, in some cases, you've just got to accept that the end is near, and at that time, you need to have someone who is very good at communicating the different palliative care options instead of trying to chasing. That's a serious case. I think there are many other cases, many other more common ailments where, you don't get to that degree of seriousness. And in general, in the case of cancer, the side effects of the conventional treatments, while the care would be quite good, are not explained clearly. The evidence in the case of cancer care, I've got a colleague at the LSE just did a systematic review of cancer trials, and he found that a large portion of them did not use you know, outcomes like mortality and morbidity. So they weren't looking at, did it make the patient live longer or better?
Right.
They looked at
yeah.
biomarker surrogate outcomes, mm-hmm. which are supposed to be related to living better, living longer, but often are not. So
right.
that's I think that what I would stick to is, in the case of cancer, communicating the benefits and harms of the different options is... the information is not available to do that properly, and insofar it is available, I don't, in my experience certainly, and in the experience of those I've read about, is not communicated adequately in a way that's both honest and gives the patient hope.
Mm. Right. So this is really something that you think that the healthcare could pay a lot more attention to, and it would be a great benefit to everybody if they did.
Yes, I think that, I mean, communicating even... the way practitioners communicate can have a therapeutic benefit, and communicating the wrong way can cause harm. We're talking about modest benefits and modest harms, but harms and benefits nonetheless, and it doesn't cost extra money to do it properly, so there's no reason not to do it. And I would want to just draw your attention to one caveat, that it's, I'm not pointing my fingers at doctors. On the contrary, I'm saying that they are therapeutic agents, and they are not valued as therapeutic agents. The way and they should be, and if they were, many of them would be delighted, because they're not valued. They're being overloaded with paperwork, seeing too many patients in a day, and so on.
Well, I'd agree with you there, and also their clinical expertise, I think, is being downplayed these days and being replaced by computer directives, which is. I'm very sad about that, because again, it kind of reduces the relationship between the individual patient and the practitioner who's looking at them and trying to respond to their condition.
That's right. I mean, and taking it to placebo effects, I mean, if you look at the before modern medicine, I mean, I think few people deny modern medicine's brought a lot of wonderful things. And before modern medicine, I mean, a thoughtful doctor would have known that all the things they had in their kit were just placebos. So they had to focus on being great at eliciting placebo effects and comforting the patient and communicating with them. And now that skill is not valued and therefore underused. So a doctor, for example, an empathic doctor is very compassionate. It takes even 2 minutes extra per patient. They'll be considered inefficient. when in fact, they might be doing great things for their patients.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now,
yeah.
I know you've got limited time today, so I wonder if you just tell us, I know you've got a book out called Dr. You, Revealing the Science of Self-Healing, which sounds very much on topic. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the book covers some of the things we've talked about in this interview, and the book sticks to evidence from systematic reviews of randomized trials, and just shows us that there's two things that we've kind of overlooked. One is that no matter what you do, the human body has amazing self-healing properties. So you just leave it alone, it gets better from many of the things that most of us see the doctor for, that we think we need a pill for. So, you know, colds, the flu, many kinds of pain, anxiety. I mean, there's some simple things you can do to cure yourself from those things without moving into anything crazy. Placebo effects can be powerful for some things. Empathic communication, having strong ties with social networks, evidence from over 300,000 patients shows that having strong ties with friends, family, and social groups can, you know, add 5 years to your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the book explains the science behind those things in a way hope is informative and entertaining at the same time.
Mm. Great. All right. Well, I'll make sure there's a link to that book in the show information that goes out. I think we'll
thank
have to
you.
Leave it there. Well, look, thank you very much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you very much.
I'm really glad there are people who are taking the placebo effect seriously, as I think it's got very serious implications, particularly as we've discussed in the doctor-patient relationship. So really big thank you.
Thank you.
If you found that interesting and would like to find out more about what Jeremy described as the hard science of self-healing, then a reminder to look out his book, Dr. You. There's a link to this and to other resources mentioned in today's show on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Just click the Yes to Life show link on the homepage
and that'll take you direct to the show information page. If you listen to this over Christmas, then I send you my very best wishes for a peaceful and happy time, and I hope you'll be able to join me again next week for the very last show of 2017. Goodbye.